On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
It is Harvey and Charles, and we have very sad news. Prince has died.
Tyga just can't catch a break. According to TMZ, the rapper...
TMZ is reporting that Chris Hemsworth and his wife were at Cedars-Sinai...
TMZ is reporting that 25-year-old singer Chris Brown has a baby daughter.
TMZ is reporting that Halle Berry and Oliver Martinez are calling it quits...
TMZ is reporting that rapper Chief Keef was arrested.
TMZ is reporting that on Sunday, Doris Roberts died in Los Angeles.
The death of Prince was a shock yesterday, but it wasn't surprising that TMZ was the first to report it. Coming up, how TMZ often gets the story first. But first, in a crazy presidential race that seems perfect for TMZ, spectators of all political persuasions are complaining about the presidential nominating process. Donald Trump is particularly unhappy.
Our Republican system is absolutely rigged. I have millions of votes more. But I also have hundreds of delegates more, but that's not the same thing to me. I think the vote is the thing that you count, right? The vote.
Bernie Sanders has also called the system rigged. Well, are they right? And if so, how did we get here? So joining us now is a professor of political science, David Hopkins, teaches at Boston College. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Madeline. Glad to be here.
And also joining us, Andrew O'Hare. He's a writer at Salon. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, David, let's start with you. It seems like every state has its own particular process, and the parties within those states differ. Why do we have this crazy patchwork of primary rules?
Well, because we have a federal system of government, and the way that the national parties evolved over our history was as a sort of a conglomeration of state-level party organizations. And so we see at national conventions, of course, the delegations are there representing their states, and the states set their own rules for when they hold their primaries, whether they hold caucuses. On the Republican side, they also set their rules in terms of delegate allocation. And so we just have a system that's evolved over 200 years of history to provide a certain amount of autonomy for each state to make its own decisions about exactly how it selects its delegates.
Well, is Donald Trump right at all when he says the process is rigged?
No, he's not really right. In fact, he's benefited quite a lot from the process as it is now. What he is complaining about is that there are some states where the delegates were selected in ways that put a premium on grassroots organizing and sort of getting your supporters to show up at caucuses and conventions. And his campaign didn't really do a very good job of that. And so they did badly in some of these states that are caucus states or convention states. And so he's complaining that he didn't do well in those states, but really if his own campaign had been a little more effective, he would have gotten a lot of delegates that he didn't get. So he doesn't really, it's easy to blame the party, but really he has no one to blame but himself.
Andrew, it seems though that voters are pretty angry about how this is shaping up, and maybe it's because it hasn't really mattered that much until now, and they're now getting a close-up view of what's really happening.
Well, I think that's right. I think there is considerable dissatisfaction with the nature of this process. I agree with the other guests about the history of this, but one thing to bear in mind is that at the moment, the two parties, who of course have no official standing under the Constitution or the law or anything else, represent less than 60% of the electorate. More than 40% of registered voters are not affiliated with either party by their own description. So that's a big part of the puzzle. And we have this extraordinary phenomenon where the front runners in each party appear to be viewed negatively by a majority of the electorate for the first time ever. I think that's also a good index that, yeah, people are not really happy with the way this has gone this year.
But they're voting for those two front runners.
Yeah, it's a paradox. I mean, obviously, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have received millions of votes, and they both are viewed negatively by more than 50% of the population. But it is a patchwork. It's a patchwork of open primary states where independents can vote, closed primary states where only registered voters can vote, caucus states, actual primary voting states. It is, to my way of thinking, a big mess that whether or not it accomplishes democracy, it often doesn't feel like it.
So what would make it feel better, a national primary?
I mean, I certainly think if there was a national primary, the results in both parties would have been pretty unpredictable this year. I don't know that either of the two frontrunners would currently be in the same commanding position that they are now.
And David, a national primary, that idea is certainly not new. It's been floated for a very long time, and yet it's never gained enough traction to actually become a reality. What do you think of a national primary?
I'm not really sure about it either way. I'm not sure, certainly in this election, that we'd see anything any different from what we see now. I mean, if you look at the national polls, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are the two front runners nationally, and they're the ones winning the most delegates under the current system. So while I think that you can make a case that a national primary is more fair in a certain abstract sense, the question of whether the outcome would be that different, I think, is a different consideration. And I also think that when you have a primary election with multiple candidates running, then the question of whether you could win the national primary by winning, you know, maybe as little as 30% of the vote in a divided field, is that a more democratic system than the system we have now? I think that's debatable. And so not against national primary, but I don't think that the case is clear that we would have a fundamentally better process in practice under a national primary as compared to the current system.
Okay, let's talk about what's going to happen come the summer at the conventions. There's talk of delegates possibly changing their minds in a second round of voting or a third round of voting at the Republican convention. Do you think that could happen?
It looks like there's a chance of that on the Republican side. I mean, the Democratic side looks pretty clear at this point. But for Republicans, if Trump does not have a majority of pledged delegates in the first round of voting, there is the chance that in a future round of voting, it goes in a different direction. And that used to be very commonplace in American history. Up until fairly recently, it was very common for ballots to go multiple rounds at conventions and for the early front runner not to end up with the nomination.
Well, I think a lot of voters would be surprised by that and think that their vote actually counts.
Well, I mean, the question is, not that the votes don't count, but that you need a majority. I mean, that's the rule, is that a single candidate needs a majority. And so what happens if nobody gets a majority? It doesn't mean that the votes didn't count. It just means that the Republican voters did not speak decisively enough in favor of one single candidate to give that candidate a clear majority of delegates at the convention. So, the requirement that a single candidate get a majority of delegates has been a requirement since we've had conventions. In fact, the Democrats used to require a two-thirds majority for a while to get the nomination. I wouldn't say that means the votes don't count, but it means in a situation where the outcome of the primaries is not decisive, there has to be a process by which the party settles on a nominee.
So
I would jump in here and say that I think the Republican states are real Hobson's choice here, but I actually disagree that there's any realistic chance of them going to a second ballot. No political convention has gone to a second ballot since 1952, and I think that it's unlikely that they will choose that option, which presents like total chaos and political meltdown, as opposed to making their peace with Donald Trump, as unhappy as many of them are about that.
Andrew O'Hare, senior writer at Salon, and David Hopkins, political science professor at Boston College. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. Are you upset about the way the nominating process is working out? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Mayor Eric Eric Garcetti's $58 million plan to put body cameras on every police officer by July has fallen apart. Now the LAPD's 7,000 cops won't be outfitted with the cameras until next year at the earliest. But a bigger question is, if they do get the cameras, will anyone ever see the footage? When police shootings occur in California, it's very difficult to get even basic information about what happened. Gene Mattis looked into this for the LA Weekly. I spoke to him this morning, and I began by asking him why the body camera plan was delayed.
Well, the city council has its opinions about the contract and whether this is the right contractor and should it be looked at again. And the mayor is trying to get it done a little bit quicker. So there's a sort of conflict between the mayor and the council about the contractor and how much it costs and how many officers are going to be required to review the videos. But it sounds like they're starting to sort of work that out.
Okay, so your story this week is about how police in the entire state of California are basically shielded from public scrutiny.
Yeah.
And you focus on how this began or the latest iteration began in San Diego. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So it was the San Diego Union Tribune that was covering the San Diego Sheriff's Department, and they got a tip that there was a sheriff's deputy who had raped somebody and had been fired for it. And so they looked into the case and reported it. What they did is they went to the Civil Service Commission and they pulled up the records and saw the whole thing back and forth. And they reported on it, and the sheriff's union flipped out, basically, did not like that. And so the next time the paper went in to try to cover another one, basically they went to court. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in support of the police union that basically this stuff should be secret. This was 2006.
The California Supreme Court. And
yes.
What did the court say? Why should it be secret?
All other police disciplinary records were secret. This was sort of seen as the one exception. And so why should there be this exception was basically the idea.
So it's been 10 years.
Yeah.
Can you see a before and after in terms of what is uncovered?
Before, there was at least a sort of baseline understanding that a certain amount of stuff was going to be public no matter what, whether somebody wanted you to know about it or didn't want you to know about it. Afterwards, you only find out about this stuff if somebody is charged criminally. But until it gets to that point, if somebody just makes an allegation that, let's say, a deputy raped somebody and they're fired for it, you would never hear about that unless the deputy was actually charged.
And here in Los Angeles, I believe the DA hasn't charged a police officer in something like 15 years.
Yeah, if we're talking about shootings, it's like one police officer was charged with assault for a shooting out of 2,000 cases. So it's an extremely rare circumstance that you would hear about this.
Now, their argument is, look, we have a uniquely difficult job. We shouldn't be under constant scrutiny and second-guessed for these decisions that are often life or death decisions.
Yeah, their argument is there are layers of oversight. They just happen to be private. So it doesn't become a public issue. It doesn't become a political thing.
Now, you argue in your piece that the Rampart police corruption scandal, which was probably one of the worst police corruption scandals in modern history, may not have been uncovered had it happened after this ruling?
I think what wouldn't have been uncovered is the level of detail about how the department responded to the scandal. The scandal came out of a criminal case, which is a public matter. But then, so there were all these allegations against all these LAPD officers, and there was a question about whether these allegations were well-founded or not. Without access to those hearings, you would never have any idea of how those things were adjudicated, whether these officers were found to be bad cops or not bad cops. A lot of them were sort of, the evidence against them was pretty flimsy. You would never know that now because you wouldn't have access to that proceeding.
So now what do reporters rely on to get these stories?
Now it's got to be either a criminal case or a civil case or tips and
leaks,
basically. You know, one of the cases we talked about was Robert Federici at the LA Times, who got this massive leak of hundreds of background files on sheriff's deputies. These were all these sheriff's deputies who had been hired from another agency. And they had lowered their standards to let these folks into the department. And so a lot of them had really checkered backgrounds. And some background investigator, evidently, was so outraged about this that they ended up sending it all to Robert Federici. And he ends up going out and knocking on doors of all these deputies and asking them about it and then writing a big story about it. And what happened as a consequence of that story is that the leaker was investigated by the sheriff's department. and the deputies are still on the force and everything. It was somebody taking a big risk in their career and in their life to make this known and putting themselves at risk of criminal prosecution.
So let's talk about the shooting of Brendan Glenn. He was a homeless guy in Venice. Police Chief Charlie Beck has recommended prosecution of the officer who shot him in the back.
Yeah.
Now it's up to the DA to actually do that. What will we know about these proceedings and what will happen to the officer?
If the officer is criminally charged, then you'll be able to see a charge. And if it goes to a preliminary hearing or a trial, then you'll see most of the evidence. There is video of this incident, which has not been released publicly. The lawyers for the family have not seen it. The only people who have seen it are within the LAPD or the attorneys for the officer himself. But, you know, no one outside of the LAPD other than that has seen this video. All of these other cases around the nation have become a big deal because of video, because video has been made public and it's on TV. In California, that kind of record is just not released. And so this story conceivably could be a bigger story, a much bigger story. We've got an officer who the police chief says shot somebody for no reason that he can figure out. The difficulty of getting access to records has sort of kept this a local thing.
And that difficulty, you write, is stronger and harder in places that are considered liberal, California, New York, whereas law and order states like Texas and Florida, they have much more open records access.
Yeah, you would think it would be the opposite. You would think like liberal progressive states would be the ones who are sort of out front in terms of holding police officers accountable, and that more law and order states would be lagging behind or more secretive. And it's exactly the opposite because of the difference in how police unions have power.
Well, on another note, today is your last day at the LA Weekly.
Yes.
So you're going to Variety.
Yes.
To cover movies and be an investigative reporter covering the industry.
Yeah.
But you are part of a vanishing breed of investigative reporters covering the city here in LA. So we will miss your reporting.
Well, thank you. I mean, and that's one of the things that was kind of poignant about covering this particular story is you have the San Diego case where they went and they tried to get these records and they got shut down and they got everything else shut down in the whole state. And the reporter who was trying to investigate that stuff ended up getting laid off and he couldn't find a job for a while. And now he's like working for the county. And so the Union Tribune is a diminished enterprise, and it's not able to go after this stuff in a way that it had been 10 years ago. It's harder and harder to hold these folks accountable if you don't have reporters with the resources to do it and you don't have the legal access to do it.
So is this your last story for
this
the weekly?
This is my last story. I mean, this is, you know, I was sort of thinking about, like, what do I think is important that I want to make it my last story? And this sort of rose to the top.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Jean Mattis, a reporter for today at the LA Weekly. Coming up, another investigative news organization, TMZ, broke the news that Prince died. It often breaks news, but it's not considered a serious news organization by serious news organizations. Should that change? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When TMZ first reported on Prince's death yesterday, the world's trusted media sources, wire services, national and international papers, were reporting only that police were investigating a death at the Paisley Park estate. As we know now, TMZ was right. Nearly 20 minutes after TMZ announced the news, the Associated Press published its account, and then other media outlets followed. But TMZ was first. It was first to report that story, as it was when Heath Ledger died back in 2008 and Michael Jackson in 2009. How does TMZ do it? Joining me now is Nicholas Schmidl. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's reported extensively on TMZ. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So TMZ has been on top of the Prince story from the get-go. And even this morning, it posted a headline saying Percocet triggered OD days before death. Let's listen to what TMZ executive editor Harvey Levin had to say on Fox this morning.
He had at least four visits to his local Walgreens pharmacy, and that's not particularly unusual, except he had somebody else go inside. He was in the car, and we have a picture of him last night in the parking lot. We're told he was sweating and pacing, waiting for the person to come back out.
So how does TMZ get these pictures?
Well, I mean, so they have sort of concentric circles of sources. And, you know, look, if you go to the TMZ website right now, at the very top of the TMZ website is a link where you can email in a tip, a phone number where you can call in a tip. If you go to the New Yorker website, the New York Times website, CNN, KCRW, I assume, many others, you have to dig around and look for a bit to figure out how to actually get a story there. So TMZ has cultivated a reputation for being a place that pays for stories, pays for pictures, pays for tips. And so when someone like Prince, and I don't know the exact details, but say someone like Prince is wheeled into a hospital on a gurney, you know, if you're a hospital employee and you think you can make $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 by calling TMZ and leading them on to a story, then you do it, and they make it easy.
And he has no qualms about paying for sources, paying for tips. He doesn't think that violates any journalistic ethics, or he doesn't care.
So Harvey Levin's his claim is that they don't pay strictly for information, which is a little questionable. But they pay tip fees, and they pay what they call licensing fees. So if someone there's a photograph up on the website right now of Prince standing out, or a person who appears to be Prince standing outside of a large SUV, and they would pay a handsome amount of money for that photograph, and then they would be able to license it. So, but no, he has no qualms. I mean, his contention is that the final product is the final product, and the photo speaks for itself.
And then it turns out usually that they're right. Are they ever spectacularly wrong?
They are wrong on occasion, but I don't think that they're. I don't think that they issue corrections any more frequently than any other news organizations. There was an episode regarding photographs of John F. Kennedy, supposedly of John F. Kennedy several years ago, in which the photos were sold to TMZ showing a man who resembled JFK on a yacht with a bunch of topless women jumping in the water around him. And it turns out that they had been totally taken for a ride, and that the photo was actually a black and white photocopy of, I think, a 1973 Playboy shoot. And so there are, you know, there are episodes like that here and there. But they insist on, I mean, what they do is they insist on documents. They insist on photos. They insist on sort of incontrovertible evidence, and which actually that in and of itself is what has in many ways allowed TMZ to transform the way that celebrity news is covered, because no longer can a celebrity say, no longer can a story come out, say in the National Enquirer, without photos or video, and a celebrity then in those stories could just say, yeah, that's not correct, and sort of blow it off. Here, you know, it's sort of unimpeachable evidence that's presented and put out in the public realm.
Yeah. So they make sure that it's not doctored. They make sure it's actually real.
That, you know, they also sort of double and triple check sources. But yeah, I mean, look, it's, there is a lot of money changes hands. The vast majority of the big stories come through scoops. Through tips. There's not a lot of enterprise reporting, but once a tip comes in, and enterprise reporting, for those who aren't familiar, you know, they don't identify a story and say, okay, this smells funny, go spend 4 weeks digging into that and see what you come back with, which is kind of the traditional investigative journalistic model. Tips will come in, and then they will, you know, they're very well sourced around LA particularly, but increasingly, as this story shows, around the country as well. And they're able to get on the phone and find people who can corroborate and double check and confirm.
Yeah. So you call LA a city of stool pigeons for TMZ. Does it have a bunch of people on retainer?
It does. It has people. So they're, again, kind of getting back to the concentric circles. I mean, there are people who are on retainers. There are people who every day, you know, as the photographers are walking around LAX, you know, they're dropping 50 here, 50 there, and we were able to obtain a large number of internal emails in which these photographers describe, you know, X person at Hudson News, this person at the juice stand. You know, they have, I mean, LAX particularly, the number of names is staggering. And so, you know, there is someone at Delta who for I don't know if that relationship continues to till today, but for a very long time was presenting them with all the details about celebrity customers when they were flying in, when they were flying out. A limousine company was presenting them with also a customer list. So, you know, they do seem to sort of know who's moving about the city at any given time. And in that way, as we describe in the piece, you know, TMZ in many ways resembles an intelligence agency as much as a news gathering one, because all of that information is not always published. And you know, as to why certain information isn't published, it's hard to know. But information is power. And if you, you know, That's kind of that gets into the psychology of Harvey Levin and why certain stories do and don't run.
Right. So I'm wondering, you know, people are now thinking, TMZ, it should be given more credibility in serious news circles. Do you think that's going to happen?
I think it's inevitable. I mean, I think this same exact conversation that we're having now happened in 2009. I've watched, when I was reporting the story, went back and watched some old video clips from after Michael Jackson was killed. And the same conversation was happening then. And so it's now been 7 years, and they've broken, you know, we think about Donald Sterling story they broke, the Ray Rice story, the Baltimore Ravens running back they broke. You know, a number of very, very, very important, significant stories. And so, you know, I kind of have to wonder that if we're still doubting whether in their realm, in that celebrity news realm, if we're wondering whether they're accurate, I think we're probably wasting time, because I think they probably are most of the time.
Nicholas Schmidl, staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Do you trust what you hear and read on TMZ? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the artist David Hockney was born and bred in Britain, but he came into his own right here in Los Angeles.
He's very English in L.A., and he's quite American when he's in the U.K.
How an Englishman captured the California sensibility, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The artist David Hockney grew up in the gritty industrial city of Bradford, England. It rains a lot there, but his most well-known work is filled with Southern California light and color, a painting of a pool in the Hollywood Hills, or a photo montage of the Pear Blossom Highway. A new documentary about Hockney explores how these two contradictory places inform his work and his outlook. Hockney is 78 years old. He's still going strong, creating new art and exploring new mediums. Randall Wright is the director of Hockney, and he joins us now from the BBC in London. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Well, Hockney seems to be the epitome of the English artist who comes here, discovers Los Angeles. But many of them, like Evelyn Waugh, for example, who came here, seem to have a bit of a jaundiced critical eye about Los Angeles. But he didn't. He seems to love it honestly and entirely. What did he discover when he came here in 1964?
I think he was looking for a Shangri-La, a place that had all the things that were missing. There was no one to tell David what to do in Los Angeles. He'd grown up in sort of enlightened but still working class and relatively tough kind of place, industrial place, as you say. And art then was grey, brown. It was about quite strict traditional subjects. And it was fantastic for David in one sense, because he learnt to draw. But he was attracted to the artist's life, to Bohemia. And all those things weren't there in Bradford. They were a little bit more there in London. But then there was another form of restriction, really. There was a restriction on the way in which he could express himself as a gay man. And of course, if you count, as David does, that Hollywood is a place for making amazing pictures, it was also filled with what David would see as artists, picture makers. So he was just thrilled by it. It was hot. It was colourful. It was full of talented people. It was unconquered as a sort of artistic sort of milieu, and it was everything he was looking for.
Yeah. Well, he said, I lived in Bohemia, and Bohemia is a tolerant place. He was talking about Los Angeles?
I think he's talking about an attitude of mind. It's this thing of control. He sees the world as a place that's become full of bossy people. He designed a badge that said, end bossiness soon. I think Los Angeles has a different kind of sense of an openness and freedom to perhaps London. London, you could still argue, is ridden with class. But California, for David, is now affected very much by political correctness. You know, he'd like to be able to smoke in a few more places than he's allowed to. So
he's sort of unrepentant about smoking. He's a staunch defender of it, in fact. And, you know, this doesn't seem to be tolerated very well here in Los Angeles.
But it's not so much that he's encouraging people to smoke. What he's saying, I would say, is to accept people who live in different kinds of ways. I mean, in the UK, we used to have this place where you went to be unhealthy, which was called a pub, and you smoked there and you drank there. And in a way, everybody, you know, perhaps people with problems were visible in society. Now, as in California, we've stepped into a world where we're constantly looking after people's health, and a lot of people are retreating to their flats, to their, you know, to their apartments, where they might, you know, take drugs or whatever, and they're no longer on view. So David's talking about tolerance and openness as much as a sort of campaign to try and make everyone into a smoker.
Now, he says, David Hockney says, he's really interested in looking at things carefully. He says he paints the same people over and over again to really understand them. And the reputation, at least, or the cliche here in L.A., is that it is all about surface. And I think he explores that in his pool paintings, surface and what that means visually. But the cliche being that L.A. doesn't really look at things too deeply. How did he reconcile that, these two ideas?
If you look at the painting, A Bigger Splash, I think you can find out a great deal about this, because it is about, as you like, the broken surface, the splashes, the displaced water. It's a sort of figurative painting. It's the water displaced by a body, but the body's under the water, and the body's never going to come to the surface. So you see something very exciting and almost sort of comic and very sexual, and it's something entertaining and something sort of hedonistic, but you're also very strongly aware of the detachment, you know, the difficulty of making contact with someone. And so I think David plays brilliantly with this idea of surface, because he's using it to point out both the beauty of things and the intangibility of that beauty and the difficulty of actually reaching it. David's looking for love. He's not necessarily always finding it.
He's looking for love where and from whom?
I think David's looking for love in another person, as straightforward as he seems. A lot of people would say he was, he's someone who's entertaining and paints pretty pictures. But I think in looking very intensely at something and revealing the beauty of something, I think he's trying to discover where the beauty is. And I think he's sometimes finding it and sometimes not finding it. He's that generation who very much grew up with the awareness of everything that was all the atrocities of the Second World War. He was a very early member of CND. He's very, very aware of the evil that people can do. He reads a lot about the Second World War. What he's trying to draw our attention to is the potential in things for creativity, to actually become aware of what's around us and what the potential in things is around us.
That's interesting that he is steeped in the history of World War II, and as you say, he's interested in nuclear disarmament. And yet his paintings and his photography seem to be apolitical or not interested in politics or a political comment per se.
But what could be more political than trying to change the way we see? His amazing films, which are, as you say, at some level they are a simple delight. But David's also pointing out that the single screen, the screen we spend most of our lives looking at, is locked into a single perspective. It's a fragment of reality. It's not all that's there to be seen. So he's actually, you could argue he's attacking a convention. And he's also saying something about how the artist who was displaced from the centre of culture by photography, by cameras, by Hollywood, you could argue, by the success of films, that artist who was displaced from the centre can find a way back to the centre by using all that technology and finding ways of being able to use it sensitively.
Yeah, so he is controlling what you see, but he's giving you many different options.
Yes, he's offering you a different sense of time and space.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Randall Wright, the director of the new documentary Hockney. It opens in Los Angeles and New York this weekend. He is 78 years old. He's not young anymore, but still really interested in new technology. And I'm thinking about his drawings on the iPad and these videos that you're talking about. How does he view technology?
He's incredibly alert to the potential in things. The way it allows him to represent something, a new technique, is very attractive to David. And I would guess, I don't know if you agree with this, but I would guess the reason is he has such extraordinary facility that he's attracted to things that are more difficult to use. And in a sense, force him to continue to discover new ways of representing. So he's very, very interested in new technology and he's used it a lot. But the key point is that what he wants is to use it with his heart. He wants to engage his heart in the use of this technology. He would talk a lot about drawing. Drawing is incredibly important because, unlike photography, when you hold a pencil and you touch the paper, you're not just reflecting exactly what you see, but you're also reflecting what you feel as well. So the picture becomes a unique record of your human response to something. So it all starts with that.
You obviously spent a lot of time with him. He seems really charming on screen. Is he, in person, as charming as he seems in your movie?
He is. He's a really, really lovely man. He's a very, very strong man. He's a very tough person. He's survived a great deal. He found a way of becoming himself, really against the odds, of ignoring prejudice about his sexuality, going his own way, despite the art world, in a sense, turning in a different direction, going more towards abstraction, minimalism, conceptual art. David stuck with representation. He has homes in London and in LA, and he's still searching. And what that means is he's still acknowledging his own need to find something out. And in that way, I think he's really an extraordinary person. He's fully alive. And he's living in the moment, which is what we all, how we should all be living.
And so he still splits his time between England and Los Angeles. Does he feel at home more in one or the other?
David has lives in phases. I think he becomes his art project. And he's so thrilled by what he's discovering in whatever his art project is. If it's happening in LA, then I think LA is absolutely where he needs to be. When a project comes to an end, I think he, it's a very clever situation, and lucky situation to be in. He can shift location. He can move somewhere else where he's open to other influences and other ideas.
What kind of art is he working on now?
Well, as far as I know, he's just finishing or has finished a series of wonderful portraits. And he's been working on the installation of a huge retrospective, which will be traveling around the world.
So he says that he's going to give away many of his paintings after he dies to LACMA and to the Tate So again, yes, that seems to be an indication that he views both London and Los Angeles as his home.
Yes, he's very he's very English in LA, and he's quite American when he's in the UK. He doesn't want anyone defining who he is or where he is. And if you were to strongly suggest to him he was one thing, he would almost certainly consider doing the other. You know, in a sense, he's a contrarian. You know, he's beyond any form of kind of simple categorization.
Randall Wright, he's the director of the new documentary, Hockney. It opens in Los Angeles and New York this weekend. Randall, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up in the non-documentary category, Game of Thrones-esque fairy tales dominate the movie theaters this weekend. We'll have our regular Friday film review segment next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's a happily ever after weekend at the movies. There are two fairy tale movies coming out and a backwoods horror flick starring Patrick Stewart. Jen Yamato is entertainment reporter for The Daily Beast. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited.
Great to have you. And Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back to you, Gray.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, let's start with the major release this weekend. It's a prequel and a sequel. Somehow we'll talk about that. Here's a clip from The Huntsman, Winter's War.
I thought I had driven the weakness out of you. I thought I made you strong.
How did you draw the weakness out? What did you do? What did you do?
That's Charlize Theron.
Yeah, she was.
And Emily Blunt.
I know what she did. She was busy being fabulous. That's how she drew anything out of anybody. Charlize Theron is so good in these movies.
One of the only reasons to see Huntsman, Winter's War.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. With such a great cast. You've got...
So, Emily Blunt, uh-huh. Charlize Theron, Chris Hemsworth.
Jessica Chastain.
Jessica Chastain.
I mean, Nick
and
Frost.
And does that all add up to going to see the movie?
No. Unfortunately.
Okay. Well, like you said, the weird thing is that it's both a prequel and a sequel to Snow White and the Huntsman, which starred Kristen Stewart as Snow White and Chris Hemsworth as the Huntsman.
Right, the Huntsman whose name is Eric. It just seems a little lackluster, right?
Is it at least Eric with a K?
No. Uh-huh.
Those are good, though. I think he's kind of more alive in this movie.
He has a lot more time mm-hmm. on screen, mm-hmm. which is good, except that I'm not sure that he was really meant to continue on in this series as one of the main characters, because he and Kristen Stewart played off each other very well in the first one, which
and that was like a Snow White movie,
right?
Right? It was definitely a Snow White movie,
where she was a warrior, and it was interesting.
So, what is this? What is this prequel sequel thing? Can you explain?
Chris Hemsworth as a huntsman and Jessica Chastain as well. By the way, super cool idea. They are Emily Blunt's army. Now, she is the sister of the fabulous Ravenna, played by Charlize Theron, who, like, girlfriend chewed so much scenery in the first movie, I bet she didn't even eat at craft services during the whole shoot. And it's awesome, right? Now, she's not really in this film very much. Instead, it's Emily Blunt, and it's a considerably different character. Not as much fun. But she's the one that created the Huntsman. And therein lies the prequel portion of the story. Then things get blurry. It begins difficult for me to explain the film in a good, like, way that, you know, limited by time on radio.
It is a movie that continually keeps changing into a different movie. Emily Blunt plays basically Elsa from Frozen, only grown up and having had learned a very hard lesson about being a woman in the world.
Yes.
This movie is it's interesting because it's really about older women as opposed to, like, teenage princesses coming mm-hmm. into their own. It's about women grappling with motherhood and career and what if you want to put your career ahead of having babies or starting a family, like Charlize Theron's character?
Right. Well, and so the movie kind of fast forwards and it glazes over, you know, what we've already seen in Snow White and the Huntsman. And then all of a sudden, when Ravenna's gone, her mirror's up for grabs and Emily Blunt wants it.
Uh-huh.
That is only the premise. That is the beginning wow. of the movie.
Sounds like it has too much plot to handle.
Yeah, I can't for the life of me explain this movie succinctly.
Okay, next up, another fairy tale. This movie is called Tale of Tales.
Hunt a sea monster. Cut out its heart. You will become pregnant.
The husband of a princess can only be discovered through a tournament.
What if I don't love him?
You will.
Where have you been hiding all this time? How old are you?
Open up this door so I can see you. Show me what you promised.
My, okay. This is not just one movie. It's three movies, right, Jen? It's three yes. fairy tales in one.
Tale of Tales is set in the like 17th century Italian countryside. It's three intertwining tales. They're really fables based on these Baroque stories. It's by this Italian director, Matteo Garrone, who... This is a very, very different kind of movie for him. He made Gomorrah, for example, and this is his first English language movie. It's really beautiful to watch, but what it is it's a fantasy horror movie for adults.
Hmm.
And it's very subtle in its
humor.
So
don't bring the kids to this.
If they like dark stuff, but movies yeah. With Jungle Book being released and so popular, kids are apparently not afraid of stuff that scares me as an adult woman anymore.
I mean, the scariest
but there's
images
some, there's
are...
some sexy time in here, right?
There's sexy time. Yes, there is. But there's also like amazing images of like Salma Hayek playing a queen who is so distraught that she can't conceive that she takes this necromancer's advice to send her husband, the king, played by John C. Reilly.
Whoa.
Yes.
Oh.
That's an interesting bit of casting, but he goes to hunt a sea monster so that she can devour its heart and become pregnant. And that is how the chain of events begins.
Yeah, it's an old-timey fertility doctor.
And another movie about women and babies and
yeah,
careers.
Tale of Tales is actually very interesting that it's also about women. The three stories are told from women's point of view. There's a tale about a mother, there's one about a daughter, and there's one told from the perspective of two sisters.
Hmm.
So it's a very...
Do you recommend?
I do. I love it. The visuals are so gorgeous. And I think it's a very subtle and very profound sort of movie to bask in if you have the patience for it.
Okay.
Otherwise, go see Huntsman.
Or another movie that I'm not sure is as sophisticated. It's called Green Room. Here's a clip.
Gentlemen, you're trapped. Things have gone south. It won't end well.
You can't keep us here, man. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. You're just staying.
Get ready to run.
Here we go.
Careful now.
All right, Jen, this is about a punk rock band who is held captive by rednecks.
No, not rednecks. Neo-Nazis.
Oh, okay. So even
it's amazing. Green Room is one of my favorite movies this year.
Really?
Yes, yes. And it doesn't exactly fit into this week's theme that we're talking about of, you know, women's stories.
Right, no, not a lot of fertility coming from Patrick Stewart as a neo-Nazi.
But Patrick, okay, wrap your head around this. A punk band in the Pacific Northwest, fronted by Anton Yelchin and Alia Shawkat, they get booked in this neo-Nazi club where they accidentally see something they are not meant to see and then become trapped and have to fight their way out of a neo-Nazi compound that is run by Nazi Patrick Stewart.
Awesome.
Captain Picard.
This director, Jeremy Saulnier, he also did Blue Ruin, which mm-hmm. is a really great movie off the radar. And so I can't wait for this one.
It is intense and brutal and really interesting in what it has to say and explore about like why people join tribes, you know, like punk rock, the punk rock aesthetic, or even, you know, if you feel like you kind of like understand what would draw somebody to gravitate towards white supremacy.
So what, you not that you're feel rooting sympathy for
you feel sympathy
captors?
For some of the neo-Nazis.
Well, because you know some of them have to just be there because they had nothing better to do. That's how I started knitting.
That's how I started karaoke.
Watch out for those needles, those knitting needles. They can really be deadly.
It's a really great movie, though, so I highly recommend it. It is very, very brutal, so you have to be sort of ready for that kind of movie.
Okay, last up.
Prince in his first motion picture.
Purple Rain. Gray. Your hair's a little purpley today.
It really is, actually, an homage to him, because Prince in Purple Rain, there is nothing like Prince in Purple Rain. What an unbelievable figure he is. God, and all that lace. What man could wear lace like Prince?
And that, speaking of sexy time.
Oh, whoo! Yeah.
He was so sexy for being, what, like 5'5"?
Ain't about the height, right? It's all what you're throwing out there. Because did anybody really believe that Apollonia in this movie would not be into him? Could you imagine being pursued by Prince?
So I rewatched Purple Rain immediately. I threw it on as soon as I heard the news of Prince's passing, which was devastating. And the sex scene that they have, Prince and Apollonia, where he's just like, they're facing the camera, of course, as you do when you're making sweet, sweet love in your home. And it is the most erotic,
you know,
grabby.
I haven't seen it in too long, and I'm now going to revisit it. And I do remember at a very tender age watching that scene and thinking it was like staring directly into the sun. Like, it was just, oh, what a talent. That movie screened all over the world, all kinds of revivals, because it tapped into something that is so meaningful to all of us. Like Prince's music, his attitude. We want to be that cool.
That is 25-year-old Prince captured forever on celluloid.
Wow.
Okay, so if you don't make it to the movies, just pop it in the old VCR, if you still have a VCR, that is. Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
That's Gray Drake, senior editor at Rotten Tomatoes, and Jen Yamato, entertainment reporter for The Daily Beast. And Julie Myers is here to round out the week. Hello.
Wearing purple today.
As you do.
Thank you. Like you do.
In homage.
In homage, that's right. So we talked about whether or not our primary system was broken today, and our listener Brian Duffy weighed in on Facebook with some interesting thoughts. He says, our democracy suffers the longer we persist in refusing to overhaul systems designed for a world that ran on horses and paper. He says, we are now capable of creating a 21st century voting system that ensures accuracy, privacy, and the potential to dramatically increase the level of participation among the citizenry. What's the hang up?
Maybe that desire in the first place is the hang up. Wow. Okay. Thank you very much, Julie Myers. Have a great weekend. And you have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.